Beetroot juice, used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, caused waves at the last Olympics. Clinical studies proved 2 glasses of beetroot juice per day could increase stamina by 16%. I've been using it, and this product is excellent. Beets are a nutrition goldmine, so call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. Get a 30-day supply free. That's 800-738-2198 or intelligentbeets.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We're talking all things Lyme and all things tick-borne with the Chief Scientific Officer of Global Lyme Alliance. She's Dr. Harriet Katsouris. And Dr. Katsouris, tell us a little bit about the GLA, the Global Lyme Alliance. What do they do and of what benefit could they be to people concerned about Lyme disease?
Global Lyme Alliance is a new organization that is a result of the merger between Lyme Research Alliance, based mostly in Connecticut, and Tick-Borne Disease Alliance, based mostly in the New York area. And we are that merger making us the largest nonprofit funder of research and education in Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. Our resources are multiple. We are a source of research material, educational material, school curricula, awareness programs, and the like. And the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance website also offers a list of physicians who have particular expertise in treating Lyme disease.
So what would you look for in it? You know, say you have, I mean, I get it. You know, somebody might want to see their local primary care doctor. They just got bitten by a tick or they're experiencing early symptoms of Lyme disease. They could get a test. They could get early treatment. That's a no-brainer. I'm not sure that people need to reach out to the Global Lyme Alliance for those kinds of situations. But say someone is questioning. They're still sick. They have not really resolved their symptoms. Should they use your directory to find a Lyme-literate doctor?
Yes, they can. And also, in the past, Lyme Research Alliance, when it was formerly known as Time for Lyme, raised multiple millions of dollars for the establishment of the Columbia Center for Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research under the auspices of Columbia University and the direction of Dr. Brian Fallon.
Who we've that interviewed here on this program. He's been, actually several years ago, but he's just doing some very interesting research, really trying to decide if people have, I mean, the differential diagnosis, do they have some chronic fatigue syndrome or do they have Lyme disease? Or do they have depression or some psychological problem?
Yes, it's a very complex, comprehensive evaluation program, and patients are then linked up with treating physicians if that seems to be the right course of treatment.
From what I understand, I know that the research is underway there, but I think what they have found, my impression, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is that the long-term antibiotic therapy appears to have helped some patients, not all, but helped some patients. But once it stops, many patients relapse. They're back to square one. Is that the general sense of it, or am I repeating
the
old
sense,
data?
Yes. There are a lot of patients that that did maintain an improvement, and there's been some thought that perhaps the treatment course and duration could have been modified to improve results, and these are things that are being looked at now going forward.
Right.
And but yes, a lot of symptoms did improve, fatigue and some cognitive function and things along those lines, and pain.
Here's a problem, too. For many Lyme patients, their disease bankrupts them because many insurance companies only recognize Lyme disease as, you know, the proof positive, serologically positive, Western blot criteria meeting type of Lyme disease. And there's no money available for not just oral antibiotics, but intravenous antibiotics, which are extremely expensive, correct?
That's right. Absolutely. There are organizations that do help these patients, but you're absolutely right. Some people have had to mortgage their homes, get a second mortgage, or borrow from friends and relatives. It could be an extreme situation.
And it's particularly devastating because, you know, you spend all these resources and you see all these doctors, but it's unclear that that's the answer. You know, it's sometimes sort of a shot in the dark as to whether this lengthy, elaborate treatment will ultimately prevail.
That's correct. At times it could be what we call a diagnosis of exclusion. But the truth of the matter is that this is why we need to establish a better diagnostic test, not just for a patient suspected with acute Lyme disease early on,
right,
without having to wait 3 or 4 weeks for a possibility of mounting an antibody response to the organism or the infection, but also patients who may have gone misdiagnosed or undiagnosed for a long period of time, who then, for all intents and purposes, are considered chronic Lyme patients, to find out what's in their bloodstream. And so there are a whole host of high technology diagnostic tests that we are both funding and have supported in the past that will prove promising to help both groups of patients.
Well, for example, PCR, polymerase chain reaction tests that detect literally particles of Lyme that float around in the bloodstream, not just an antibody response, because that may be an echo of an old infection. The dilemma that I have is sometimes I test patients to see if they still have Lyme, and if the test is positive, it may mean nothing. It may mean just that their immune system is still activated against Lyme disease, but there's actually no live organisms.
Right. I'm talking more in terms of metabolic byproducts of that you would only see if there were viable organisms still present, mm-hmm. or actual with genomic sequencing of non-human DNA in the bloodstream implicating an active infection.
Okay, so that would be valuable to see if there's literally particles of Lyme organisms floating around in the system, then
in
it
the
would
blood,
guide us
right.
with further therapy. Okay, so what about co-infections? Because I've heard it said, and I'm sure you've heard this analogy, that getting bit by a tick is a little bit like getting stuck by a dirty needle in a hospital. Any number of possibilities of transmission of some nasty things. So what are some of the possibilities? And can they occur simultaneously? Can you have Lyme disease and babesiosis and or ehrlichiosis? Is it one at a time? Or do they queue up one at a time? Or can you have a compound infection?
You can have a compound infection. In fact, we have funded a research project that should be nearly complete, that's analyzing what by DNA analysis, what organisms, what pathogens actually exist in the tick belly. We think the tick belly is like a virtual cesspool, like you said, of a whole host of organisms. Some of them may be disease-producing, others may just be benign and not do anything. But probably the most common ones that you've heard about that can be co-infections along with Borrelia burgdorferi are, for example, Babesia, causing babesiosis. It's what we call a protozoan organism. It's not a bacterium. It can be transmitted via blood transfusion. It can be passed in utero, and it can cause a whole host of symptoms, but the classically hemolytic anemia, a malarial type illness with sweats and shaking chills and fevers and headache and fatigue and that kind of thing. Bartonella is another one. Bartonellosis, you might also know as a cat scratch fever. And that can cause cognitive problems, malaise, headache, liver problems, immune problems, swollen glands, muscle aches, heart inflammation, an enlarged spleen, a whole host of things. On the skin, you can see stretch marks, they call it, unusual striae, we call them, or stretch marks on the skin. And that's very difficult to treat. That's a very tenacious organism, very much like Lyme disease, like the Borrelia burgdorferi. Ehrlichiosis can cause a flu-like type illness, but that also may be associated with a low white cell count and a low platelet count. White cells that fight off infection, platelets that contribute to clotting in the blood.
So, and there are reliable methodologies for testing for these diseases.
Yes.
They're not as elusive as Lyme disease?
Less elusive, that's correct.
Okay. So it stands to reason that somebody who has had a tick bite and is sick might deserve a full panel of tests, not just looking for Borrelia burgdorferi.
That's right. You have to know your area. You have to know what your ticks in your particular area are carrying. But yes, it's probably not a bad idea to do a co-infection panel. But again, just like with Lyme, it takes a few weeks to mount an antibody response. So a patient can be pretty sick for a while before being able to make a diagnosis and get them on the proper antibiotics, because not all of these are treated with doxycycline.
So here's a clinical enigma. A Brooklyn hipster comes into your office who spends a lot of time in coffee houses and bars and lives in an urban setting, rarely sets foot in nature, is pale-skinned, tattooed, of course, because that goes with the territory, and describe symptoms that sound like a Lyme disease. Is it impossible for them to have been exposed to Lyme disease? Or how can people who seemingly at low risk of wildlife exposure actually get Lyme disease?
Well, I think it speaks to the very mobile population that we have. As somebody in Brooklyn, for example, could very well be that their neighbor goes to the Hamptons and has pets, and these pets have been out in the tall grasses in the Hamptons and have carried some ticks back, and this particular hipster visits the neighbor's next door, pets the dog, gets a tick bite. I mean, things like this have happened. There are reports that ticks may actually even be in Central Park for the same reason. People uh-huh. travel, and their pets are what we call tick taxis. They will pick it up, pick these ticks up, and they'll bring them home. And sometimes they're so small that the pet owners can't even detect it on their pets.
So in looking for a doctor who is kind of a Lyme detective or a tick knowledgeable doctor, what are some of the things that patients should look out for? Does any infectious disease doctor qualify as an expert on Lyme disease, or do you favor doctors who spend more time going to the latest Lyme disease conferences, for example?
Well, I think if the infectious disease doctor is well versed in Lyme disease, and they should be, that is more than adequate. However, we like to call them Lyme literate physicians in some circles. I think that that's a bad term, personally. I think what I would say, there are some physicians who have more experience with Lyme disease and may actually know about more of the cutting edge research, or be exposed to information about cutting edge research, either because they are involved in some clinical studies, or they're associated with an academic center of excellence that is doing some particular work in that field. If a patient is sick and is not getting better, then by all means, I think they have to go, as one would for any other illness, go from the specialist to the subspecialist. But I don't necessarily believe that you have to go to a Lyme doctor right away.
Is it possible that there are some doctors who are Lyme zealots, that they see virtually anything as possibly reflecting Lyme disease, either, you know, by their personal orientation, maybe they've had Lyme disease, or a family member, or their whole practice is devoted to Lyme disease, and, you know, by hook or crook, using one or another test, and there's a lot of tests out there, some of which are, you know, probably questionable, that they come up with some smidgen or trace of reactivity to Lyme, and then you're off to the races.
Yes, it's a sad fact. Like anything else, and like any other illness that is controversial like this, there will always be people out there who will be able to benefit from other people's misfortune. That being said, some what you would call as Lyme zealots, I am sure, have all good intentions. Mm-hmm. And there are times, but if you're doing it too much and you seem to see Lyme everywhere, you lose your sense of objectivity as well at times. So again, like anything else, you have to choose your physicians wisely, just like you choose the right carpenter or the right washer machine repairman. It's the same principle. You go to somebody who's reliable, sensible, and seems to know is most up to date on all of the things available out there.
However, the last time I checked, there hasn't been an epidemic of mysterious illnesses among household appliances that defies that defies treatment and diagnosis. Generally, you know, there's some good repair people and some not so good repair people, but it's a much simpler man-made construct, and you can usually figure it out. So the other question I was going to ask is any of the research being focused on natural therapies, non-pharmaceutical therapies for Lyme disease? And I'm not here to, you know, minimize the importance of conventional therapies. I do believe in them. There's some holistic doctors who say, oh, antibiotics are bad. These pharmaceutical drugs, they're all poisons. You know, we like to use natural antimicrobials, or we use intravenous vitamin C, or colloidal silver, or, you know, whatever. But is there any evidence that supports the use of these things? Or is there any ongoing research to look at that as at least a supportive strategy for recovery?
Let me say it this way. It's hard enough for researchers to get funded from the government today for what one would consider mainstream diagnosis and treatment of tick-borne diseases. Despite the recommendations of the Institute of Medicine to increase funding for Lyme disease research and tick-borne disease research, funding by the NIH has actually gone down over the last several years.
So in contrast to breast cancer, for example, which is a cause celeb, it's a national emergency, and yet you're saying that Lyme disease actually, while it kills less people, it actually numerically exceeds the number of new breast cancer cases.
That's right. So to follow the previous logic, if one were to say that the government is not giving out money readily for what we would consider, and I'll put it in quotes, mainstream science, you can imagine how virtually impossible it is to get alternative medicine treatments funded by the government, so that they would have clinicians, researchers, physicians, scientists would have to more than likely seek out funds from the private sector, which the private sector is stretched. We are trying to spread our money widely and wisely and in the most fiscally responsible way. In Europe, there are some studies ongoing on the use of, for example, essential oils in the treatment of spirochetal illnesses. Now, mm-hmm. Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative organism for Lyme, is a spirochete, a corkscrew-shaped bacterium. And so in Europe, they tend to do a little bit more in terms of avant-garde cutting-edge research. And so, yes, there are some alternative medicine approaches that are being looked at in Europe, in Western Europe.
I think oregano oil has been put forward as something that might mm-hmm. have anti-spirochetal effects, although right. I'm not here endorsing it. This is my position on this, is I really believe that this is a serious infectious disease, and that the natural antibiotics or things like ozone or things like that, may have a secondary application of this, but I still think that the way to treat it is with conventional antibiotics. However, I do believe that there's a lot of room for correct nutritional support for patients. I think that diet is important. I think that attention to their hormones is important because many patients are exhausted and knocked out. I think that certain nutrients actually help the body rally and have a better immune response because, after all, ultimately, it's your own immune system that will help keep this tenacious set of organisms at bay. So I think nutrition does play certainly a supportive role, and I hope that some of the research will look at the role of, you know, say, vitamin D in support of treatment and so on.
Sure, absolutely. Like any other illness, you have to attack it from all ends to support the patient, to give the patient the best possible chance to be able to combat or fight off the infection. We're funding, in fact, several projects that are looking at how Lyme sickens the immune system and makes it incompetent so that it cannot fight off the infection. Clearly, most infections, you hit with antibiotics, you're not going to eradicate all the bugs. The immune system has to mop up the rest. And the problem is with Lyme disease, a lot of patients are not able to mop up the rest. And that's why they more than likely end up in the chronic phase. And then something goes awry with their immune system. So it's such a complex illness. We are still scratching the surface. I hope that in the next 5 to 10 years we have some definitive answers. But one thing's for certain, it's an absolute free-for-all right now in terms of finding the best, a better diagnostic test. And being privy to know what's going on out there right now with high-tech approaches, I predict that within the next 1 to 2 years, we will have a definitive diagnostic test, both for acute Lyme disease earlier than the 3 to 4 weeks after mounting an antibody response, and also a definitive test for saying someone has chronic Lyme disease.
Well, let's hope that Lyme disease becomes the HIV of the 21st century, where, you know, now, although we haven't eradicated HIV, we have a series of treatments that that can keep it at bay, and many patients are leading productive lives, you know, well into their seventh and eighth decades, living with a chronic infection that, even while it can't be completely eradicated, at least can be controlled. So, you know, but then again, the resources that have been applied to HIV have surpassed the resources applied to Lyme by a factor of probably 100 or more.
Absolutely. Yes, you hit the nail on the head. It takes more money. It really does.
Indeed. So hopefully this will become a priority. All right. So today's Intelligent Medicine call to action. Tell us about the GLA.
Global Lyme Alliance, the largest nonprofit funder for Lyme disease and other tick-borne disease research, as well as education and awareness in tick-borne diseases.
Okay, and what? How is that of any material benefit to our listeners? What can they do? Should they join? Should they contribute? Can they get resources there?
All of the above.
Okay.
We do have a landing page for our website. Our new website, because it's a newly merged entity, has a landing page with some information. It's globallimealliance.org. But the two merged entities still have their older websites up and running, LymeResearchAlliance.org and TickborneDiseaseAlliance.org. So you have three areas to access.
Okay. And
the donate button is on all three.
Indeed. All right. And you won't mind if people click on that. All right. So
absolutely
great.
Not.
Great. So, yeah. So I wish you all the best. And, you know,
Thank you.
Call on you for an update as soon as there's some new news to report on the Lyme disease research front. I'm sure it's going to be forthcoming. It's just a matter of time. And that'll be a great boon to many patients who are sort of in limbo now, suffering from challenging symptoms, hard to eradicate. With Lyme disease and co-infections, be safe, be careful. What are some of the things that people can do to safeguard against Lyme? If they're going to go out in the woods, what are just some tips in conclusion?
Wear light-colored clothing, pull their hair back, wear a hat, tuck their pants, long pants, into their socks, spray their clothing with DEET. Yes, that a chemical, I hate to say it, but as long as it doesn't, you don't put it on your skin, you're fine. And then do tick checks when you come back from a particularly tick, possibly tick-infected area. And throw your clothes into the dryer immediately upon coming home. A dryer for 15, 20 minutes will kill the ticks. And also, it's advisable after a hike, gardening, to take a shower fairly promptly, because it's much easier to do a tick check and to wash off the little buggers.
Right, and make sure you check where even where the sun don't shine, because it's not just exposed areas, because the tick can crawl to inaccessible places and sometimes lodge there. So
hairline, armpits, groin, back of the knees, those areas.
All right. So let's have a safe summer and avoid the scourge of tick-borne illness. And there's hope for sufferers of Lyme, because GLA, the Global Lyme Alliance, is on the march. And thanks very much to you, Dr. Harriet Kratsouras, for providing us with an update, and all the best to you in conducting research that's going to help patients.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.